Hi everyone. Today is May 19th and it's the new moon. We are moving into the strawberry moon. So I want to acknowledge that obviously if you're in the spring time where you live, strawberries are now a possibility again, which is so nice. It's so wonderful to enjoy the fruits of whatever season they're truly in harmony with in terms of coming to fruition. Tomatoes just taste better in August, don't they? And the lovely strawberries are particularly sweet in this time of year. So I hope you're doing really well. Welcome to part 3 of the shadow functions of the personality. We're going to explore another article that I wrote along this topic. And today's content is really about the inner marriage. And if you are familiar with Jungian or depth psychology, that is not a new concept to you. It's been such an invaluable perspective for me because my outer marriage has always been really important. And I've struggled mightily in that arena. And that is not to say I haven't had good-hearted partners and all the rest of it. I'm just saying, for whatever reason, that seems to be an emphasis of where my growth is. And what we're going to talk about today is key to really understanding this. And I'm speaking from, you know, raw experience myself with this and really hopeful experience myself with this, because my outer marriages and that wanting union and the experience of that have just really driven me deeply into my interiority, because I see now 100% that the outer must flow after the inner marriage. It cannot be the other way around. And that's the same with wealth. That's the same with vitality. That's the same with everything. And all of the work that you and I engage with and explore in this podcast is all about that horse before cart instead of cart before horse. And it's so liberating. And coming into emotional intelligence, which means, how I would define that, is being able to feel alive and to feel love and to feel power and all of those beautiful feelings, to feel grief if it needs to move through, but to not dwell there. But at the same time, not getting stuck in emoting. And I link that to feeling that has gotten lodged or stuck with an idea that is limiting in some way. So I love exploring this idea of the inner marriage, because there's a lot we can do to get out of our own way and to touch that place within us that is ever new. Releases the outer marriage, if that is important to you, or the outer partnership. There's all kinds of ways that can take form. But that releases that to a beautiful design where two human beings can just simply be human beings, but then what they experience together can truly be greater than the sum of their parts. And we're no longer projecting either our brilliance, of course, that would be the falling in love part, or our horror, you know, when that honeymoon phase is over, onto the other. It just seems so shockingly clear now what relationship and partnership are all about. There's such a crucible and container for personal growth. And you know how I normally share a poem in the beginning? I have a little reading today that I want to share in lieu of a poem today, because it's quite poetic. And the author is Ernest Morrow. And I don't know a lot about his work, but I run across his stuff occasionally. And I believe he's doing a lot of work in the couple space or in exactly what I'm talking about. So I'm sure he is worth checking out. I don't have a lot of details on him. I need to explore further. But he wrote this, and I wanted to begin with this today because it's such a great way into my piece of writing that we'll explore together. So let me just begin there, and then I'll link this to personality and the shadow here in just a second. So here we go. This is by Ernest Morrow. Your partner will never complete you. Soulmates don't exist. Your partner has nothing for you. I promise, nothing. In fact, the world has nothing for you, but most people fixate on their romantic relationship as the place they are finally going to feel complete and whole. Never going to happen. Your soul doesn't have a mate. Your flame doesn't have a twin. All just fancy, spiritualized ways of putting lipstick on the pig of codependence. It's half-hearted. The other made into a false god. The search for the other is really a search for the self. The more desperate you are to find or fix the other, the more imperative it is to learn how to receive the gift of your own life. The world is full of people who have projected their ultimate vitality into having a soulmate-level relationship. I get it. I've been there. I was captain of that team. And my days were full of tension and longing and striving and grasping and holding on, depending on what arc of the relationship roller coaster I was on. Love is easy. It's simple. And it's unrelenting. It will never give you what you think you want, because it is only ever going to give you what you need, a relationship with your own beauty. But here's the thing, it is only when you finally let love have its way with you that true intimacy with an other is possible. Love's agenda, not yours. The beautiful, embodied particularity of one sovereign being choosing wholeheartedly to share presence, breath, and body with another. Not because they complete one another, but because their sovereignty seeks expression in intimacy. How do we move from the half-hearted and completely consuming and obsessive search for love to a wholehearted and effortless expression of love? Initiation. You can't think your way there. You can't feel your way there. You can't sense your way there. You have to live your way there. If you're brave enough to knock on this door, there is an opportunity. And then he goes on, because I think he does workshopping, etc., where he offers guidance for that, which is phenomenal. That's beautiful. So check him out, Ernest Morrow. But what I'm sharing with you today is also a form of this initiation. And it's only something we can come to ourselves. And there are many facets of it. As they speak to you today, this is one of my primary lessons. I know that. And it's had many different entry points and places of deepening. And then where things, sort of take on a whole new perspective. And then we dive in again. But I must say that the reality transurfing material that you and I have explored together, what I have discovered here very recently is that, yes, that is helping us train our minds and become emotionally intelligent so that we're not whipped around by pendulums or negativity or old thoughts or just the catalog of war wounds of the human experience. So that's so fantastic and that's so helpful. And I have embraced those practices, even though, I'm not doing them on the podcast right now. They are part of my daily life. I return again and again and again to this. But what I've discovered even very poignantly in the last 10 days or so is that still mind that is facilitated by that awareness practice is a gateway. And maybe I suspected that before, but like I'm really experiencing that now. That work is not just calming. That work is introducing you to a whole other gateway of experience. It's like the bedrock of your ability to create, and I'm going to use that word in quotation marks because it's actually a choosing of the life that you want, because from this perspective, we've been exploring, you know, what you want is seeking you. What you want already exists. So it's not a matter of, oh my God, how do I have to go create this? You know, that sounds challenging. It's simply choosing and aligning with that. So see all parts passing for that discussion, you know, because we've been exploring that and we'll continue to. But and I'll do more on that shortly because I have more to say. But I want to stay focused on the inner marriage here in terms of topic and how that is relating to the personality conversation. And the shadow functions of the personality are definitely part of the gifts and challenges of the unconscious. So it's part of us that we haven't come to know yet. And so you could argue that coming into a totality of understanding all these different aspects of your own being and how part of them are in shadow and seeking to have a relationship and a conversation with that aspect of yourself, this is only benefiting any external unity or partnership, however, whatever form that might take, whether it's a business or a marriage or a life partnership or whatever, a creative project. This work of personality and understanding it and seeing how all of that can be known is a really precious thing. Now, I say that with the great caveat that this is about your human self. And if, you know, if you're part of this podcast, you know, I definitely, although we let each of us define it for ourselves, I definitely believe in the self with the capital S. So that larger aspect, that divinity within, that authenticity that is not part of the human aspect of us. So personality is linked to the human aspect of us. But that can really help us uncover some filters and some tendencies that might be blocking the brilliance and the effortless realization of divine partnership. So that is our window into the work today. And I wrote this article shortly after I finished the one on arrival that I shared with you last time. And it's called Finding the Gold in the Iron, Making the Inner Marriage. And this is work I continue to do. And the last podcast of May, which I'll post, you know, right at the end, it then takes this full circle with a third article that is really about the numinous expression of the divine. And I really look forward to sharing that with you, because all of these articles are sort of a piece. And I've said that. I didn't know that when it was happening to me. Didn't know that when I was writing them, but they certainly make sense now, which again, tells us that we're being led, we're being guided, if we're trying at all to stay any kind of awake in our dream and in our worlds. So that's very comforting to me. And the title here, Finding the Gold in the Iron, I'm referencing that folktale Iron John. And I've done podcasts on that as well. And you'll remember my dear friend, John Ferrick, joined me for that. And we had a beautiful conversation about that. So, you know, there's so many threads coming together here. I think the article itself will tie these pieces together, but just offering that there's a wealth of information in past podcasts about these various pieces, if you need to revisit, want to revisit, or haven't heard all of those. So that's where we begin today. Thank you for being witness to what I continue to discover about my own heart. And I hope this is very helpful for all of us today. I intentionally didn't read it. Obviously, I wrote it several years ago. I didn't read through it. I'm going to be experiencing it with you because I thought that might be kind of cool to just say organically what's coming up for me, because we never enter that same river twice. And so I'm bringing a new perspective to what I wrote, and we'll see what happens. Okay. So here we go. Finding the gold in the iron, making the intermarriage. Astonishingly, the cat could still move. Astonishing, because the cat was severed in two. Riveted, I confirmed with my eyes what my bare skin sensed. The ticklish rub of a gray tiger feline walking in figure eight patterns around my ankles. I was horrified, but she did not appear the least bit agitated. In fact, she seemed to simply want my attention. Back and forth she went. The images of the dream began to swirl as I realized that the scene was both real and not real. A feline messenger from my psyche had put me on notice. It was time to tend to the sensual life. As she traced the patterns of infinity, this courageous animal, instinctual and clearly a survivor, was paradoxically revealing both her timelessness and her need of me. Her midsection was cut in profile, so I could easily see her guts, frozen yet not cold. Her pink innards were contained, but there was no vital blood flow. The life force was static. Miraculously, she continued to function, but not in her wholeness. This premier symbol of sensuality and independence was giving voice to a part of me deep within, injured but still alive and seeking healing and union. And she arrived within days of my meeting the man who is now my second husband. I was married for 17 years to an alcoholic. Our life was not always turbulent. In fact, the searing truth is that I loved him deeply and we shared many happy times. But as my own unquenchable curiosity about the life of my soul took center stage in my consciousness, my former husband turned to liquor to deal with both the shifting dynamics between us and the initiatory call of his own life that he had thus far refused. An acute pain links the awakening soul with the ending of a marriage, for one cannot go back to how things were. When, through a transcendent moment of grace, a light is cast in the depths of the psyche, one cannot unsee what one has seen. I had perfected the twisted art of emotional contortion in my sincere efforts to keep the toxic marriage alive. But life was not having it anymore. It saved me in the form of my husband's infidelity and unthinkable betrayal. Redemption can arrive in the ugliest forms. Fairy tales reveal this motif time and again, but the archetypal framing of these events helps me continue to heal, for though my soul is breathing more easily, my ego took a big hit. From a depth psychological perspective, a marriage is not only a dynamic story of two, but also a mirror of the innermost soul workings of one, a journey of the disparate parts of one's self-seeking integration, finding their way home. If I have learned anything about marriage, it is this. The greatest legacy I can offer my outer marriage is soulful, abiding attention to my inner union. I'm going to pause there for a moment because I grapple with, at this moment in my life, saying anybody is anything. You know, like at the time I wrote this, I had several years where I was learning about, you know, how alcohol addiction, and obviously addiction of any kind, which we all have addictions to certain extents. You know, you could probably say I was spiritually addicted at that time because I've become much more mature in how I look at my own spirituality now. So I would say it in such a fuller way, or maybe even not at all, because I don't want to label any person in my life as this or that. I don't want to, you know, sort of give that sentence to anyone. It's not fair. at this moment in time, I was definitely having to look at my part in the addiction cycle and that dance and how to think better. And definitely, if you know, if you followed my podcast, you know I talk about those three broad sections of humanity where we have the plank on head, which is very dense evolutionary trajectory, and we have the certified life coach space where we're getting wiser to ourselves, where we're learning about a bunch of concepts, and then the I am space, which a lot of this podcast is dedicated to, is like exploring the greater mystery and even going beyond really helpful psychological concepts. This article was first written in that, you know, psychological space where I was learning about codependency and things like that. And the thing I'll say is I don't even know when it happened, but I was feeling empowered by sort of, you know, getting support and reading good books as that marriage ended, because it made sense. And certainly in the personality structure I have, to educate myself, to take a scholarly approach to help myself stabilize a bit and to learn. But somewhere along the way, I can't remember if somebody, I think it was something I read. It wasn't a conversation I had, but I remember something I read about, you know, alcohol abuse, etc. And then, you know, finding your way out of that, if you've been in a family that's been affected by that, okay, all good stuff. But the piece of wisdom that stuck with me so profoundly said, don't get stuck here. In other words, don't make this your new identity. That is so powerful. I'm sure that was my soul itself speaking through that book to me. And it applies to everything. If you are a cancer survivor, if you are a whatever survivor in terms of a health scare, if you, you know, have been in a past relationship where, quote, the other was XYZ or 1, 2, 3, and we have a label for that of some kind, whatever, fine, it's helpful. We move through, we learn, we grow. My heartfelt wisdom on that is just don't get stuck there. You are more beautifully defined than that. So yes, that may be part of your human story, but define yourself in affirmative terms, in gracious terms, in loving terms. Go deeper than that part of your story. And I want to offer that to, you know, just largely here, my former husband, who is so much more than whatever he was dealing with at the time. And I honor that. I honor that in a huge way. So that is definitely coloring everything I'm sharing with you now. And that will only help us continue to be good parents to our kids. So I definitely want to make that clear. Moving on in my article, The Caged Panther. In discovering the potential of my inferior function, remember we talked so much about that last time, extroverted sensation, I began to strengthen my animus. After the cat dream, my wounded animus showed up again in the form of another magnificent cat, a caged panther. Deep in graduate studies, I read the poem by Rilke titled The Panther. He wrote, "The passing of the bars fatigues his gaze so much that it can hold no more. To him, it is as if each bar were a maze that led to another and another barred door. The quiet pacing of strong and supple limbs that turn around the very smallest sphere is like a dance of power around the rims of circles that hold a great will numb in there." By the time I read this, though my outer circumstances had greatly improved, I was nevertheless in my negredo time, that period of chaotic confrontation with one's darkness and unlived life, which takes as long as it takes. Reflecting back on the end of my first marriage, I knew when the negredo phase had begun. Lying on my side in bed in broad daylight, I was staring out the window at the distant mountains like the panther in this cage. When my husband came striding into the room, he halted, tensing at what he saw, knowing he could no longer avoid the cost of recent revelations of his behavior. He lay down beside me and attempted to put his arm around me. I stiffened, curling tighter into a fetal position. And then from a voice that was not my own came the words I had no awareness of speaking. Something's dying. The voice was not referring to the marriage. In effect, it had already ended. The voice was also not referring to his behavior. The voice came from a place both ancient and familiar, a place that had not made its presence known in quite a while. It was the voice of my soul announcing ashes and shadow. I was both transfixed and oddly comforted to learn that the great Rilke had endured a similar darkness. Poet and translator Daniel Polakoff portrayed a time when Rilke was creatively frozen, disillusioned with the manner in which he had thus far approached his art. A fortunate mentoring by sculptor Auguste Rodin assisted the mercurial Rilke as he embraced an entirely new movement in his work, honoring the dignity of the object. The highly sensate Rodin challenged Rilke to go to the zoo and intensely observe the animals, the thing itself. The result was the panther, an entirely new phase of Rilke's poetry. While I cannot speak to Rilke's psychological type, in connecting with the foreign nature of my own extroverted sensing inferior function, I sensed the tremendous value in this exercise. What seized me from the first time I read The Panther was ironically not the aching, caged containment, but the life pacing to break free, the wild current in the spaces between the bars, the electricity beginning to spark deep within my own being. Quote, "Only seldom does the pupil's curtain slide soundlessly up. Then an image enters, ripples through the tensely stilled stride, and ceases where the rhythm centers." I wanted to scream a guttural war cry. It was time to know the agency that had been quietly gathering, and it became increasingly clear I would need the otherworldly assistance of my inferior SE to do so. It seemed the perfect storm was brewing. My awakening animus and my underdeveloped SE were in need of guidance. As synchronicity would have it, I picked up a copy of storyteller and poet Robert Bly's Iron John, a book about men. Though I had read it years before, the folktale's wisdom leapt off the page anew, feeding a wary yet hungry sojourner, my neglected animus. In immersing myself in the story of Iron John, I discovered that a man needs to both seek his feminine side and form a connection with his wild nature. Iron John speaks to the latter. I realized that the folktale had a similar message for me. I was a woman on such a mission. In addressing the classical Jungian definition of animus, analyst and author Clarissa Pinkola Estes revealed that, quote, "The revivifying source in women is not masculine and alien to her, but feminine and familiar. But she nevertheless believes the animus concept to have import." She said, "Animus can best be understood as a force that assists women in acting in their own behalf in the outer world. Animus helps a woman put forth her specific and feminine inner thoughts and feelings in concrete ways, emotionally, sexually, financially, creatively, and otherwise, rather than in a construct that patterns itself after a culturally imposed standard of masculine development in any given culture." "The animus is an essential bringer and bridger," said Estes. "He is like a merchant of soul." Thus, an engagement with Iron John provides men and women alike the opportunity to relate to a robust animus, not often embraced in the culture, an animus in service to the feminine along her path to unity, the ultimate marriage. As I read Bly's exploration of 8 distinct phases of the masculine journey, I readily came to see the stark contrast between the animus models I had historically experienced and the vibrant, engaged animus that could be. And as I continued to digest this remarkable tale, 3 salient points struck close to home: reclaiming the golden ball, tending the wild garden, and establishing inner sovereignty. As the young boy matures in the story of Iron John, so did my growing animus sensibility. From the folktale, there was once upon a time a king who had near his castle an enormous forest in which wild animals of all sorts lived. One day he dispatched a hunter into those woods to take a deer, but the hunter did not return. "Something went wrong out there," said the king. So this part now leads us to reclaiming the golden ball, the audacity of play. From the outset, the tale points to the untamed part of the interior life. The king keeps losing hunters in a remote area. Even he is at a loss about how to proceed until an intrepid young man arrives saying that this is just the sort of adventure he seeks. The man loses his dog to the cause, but discovers a wild, hairy man living at the bottom of a lake. After a posse of men drain the lake and capture the savage now referred to as Iron John, the king's curious 8-year-old son, playing in the palace courtyard, loses his golden ball as it rolls into Iron John's cage. A conversation begins, and 2 things are certain: the ball will only be returned when Iron John is set free, and the key to this cage has been deposited under the queen's pillow. Bly referenced Jung as saying the psyche likes to make deals. He added, quote, "Conversing with the wild man is not talking about bliss or mind or spirit or higher consciousness, but about something wet and dark and low, what James Hillman would call soul. There comes a time when one has to gather the enterprise to strike out on one's own, free of the niceties of acculturated parenting or, in regard to type development, the preferred functions. My superior function of introverted intuition often knows what is needed or should be done even before others contemplate such ideas. Additionally, my auxiliary function of extroverted feeling helps me to interact with others, quote, so as to accomplish goals that serve the best interests of all concerned." All of that from Carol Shoemate's work. N.I. and F.E. assisted me as a kid in cluing into my parents' and younger brothers' moods, but the shadow aspect of these gifts is that I was frequently in an adult role. For example, I remember how the kitchen telephone would ring and my mom, jaw clenched and rolling her eyes, would refuse to answer because she knew it was my grandma. Feeling guilty, mom would then vent to me about her frustrations with her own mother. Even though I was only 8 years old, my strong N-I-F-E combination partially understood what my mom was talking about. But these adult exchanges kept me from simply just running outside to play. I was often such a good listener, being the Dear Abby of my family, that I think I began to actually mistrust play because there was no familiar rewards associated with it. My family did not need me to play. Rather, they needed me to hear them and provide a sounding board. This reinforced an identity that was rooted in both NI and FE, but as one enters adulthood, an exaggerated reliance on the preferred functions is insufficient. Those with SE in the inferior position, according to Shoemate, may find a creative outlet in artistic endeavors. And my inferior function, extroverted sensation, began to emerge when at midlife I wanted to give expression to my artistic side. An artist must play in order to create and must be allowed the space and time to fail without worrying about everyone else's feelings. This is the golden ball I had lost long ago, when my 8-year-old self exchanged her sense of autonomy and play for the greater demands of the family's emotional comfort. Playtime still feels a little indulgent to me, an activity I should only do when everyone else's needs are met, which is never. So I want to pause here by saying this is not an indictment of my parents, because graciously, they were fine with me sharing some examples. They listened to this podcast. They have grown way past the versions of themselves when I was 8, obviously. And, you know, I honor that tremendously. We're never the same people. And, you know, I have done this to my kids. I've certainly done this to my kids. We're all in that dynamic with those closest to us. So this is not an indictment of ex-husbands, present husbands, children or parents or anything. It's just showing that these roles, personality roles in family dynamics play out in a certain way, but ultimately there is one person's responsibility to gather all that together and pivot if needed, and that is us. It's us, period. That's it. End of story. Even if I had parents that still wanted me to behave this way, which I do not, they're wonderful about supporting my own growth and my own trajectory and what I'm choosing for myself. But even if I did, it's up to me, you know, to make that pivot. And a lot of times, you know, the idea you're carrying around in your head is really the only thing limiting you, because, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what anybody else is trying to project onto you. It's up to you to set that aside. And so this is not an indictment of folks, for sure. And again, they were very gracious to let me sort of use these examples to illustrate, you know, for the purpose of this article. Moving on, illustrative of my determination to work my extroverted sensory muscle and revel in pleasure, 4 years ago at Christmas, I ran off to Ireland to marry my second husband with only my 2 children in tow. And I'll just pause here to say, you know, my family, my parents, you know, others close in my family were so supportive during the time of my divorce. And at this moment, I just felt the need to sort of reclaim my independence as a woman, recreating a family again. So, of course, my greater family was invited, but it ended up just being us. And my second husband is sort of a foreign spirit to the dynamics of my original family of origin. He was just a very worldly person, is a very worldly person, and really well traveled and just had a different approach to life altogether. And so I think it was a whole new mix and a whole new dynamic. And I know the soul's leading was absolutely an integral part of all of this. And it unleashed a whole new set of lessons and growth that I couldn't even have conceived of. But again, it's never about the external. This is a way of me finding those new layers within. So just putting a pin in that, back to Ireland. Indeed, our intention for launching our new life together was to boldly embrace new territory. Entering the SE atmosphere of sensory wonder, amber rays piercing the ancient black chamber of Newgrange on the winter solstice, rosy-cheeked carolers on cobblestone Grafton Street, pelting December rain, dark molasses plum pudding, I felt positively victorious. Reclaiming my golden ball fed my imagination, and with my free-spirited spouse leading by example, I began to open up, referring to baristas and other such occasional strangers by name, spending over an hour savoring a meal and playing Mexican-trained dominoes with my daughter. Ireland was essential to my well-being and to my awakening animus that was now in the business of negotiating the choices of a life well-lived for myself. So, you know, here I've used the word imagination. When I wrote this article, I had no idea how important that faculty was going to become for me. So that just, again, it was prescient of something and precious moment, but boy, on and on we evolve. Next point in the article, tending the wild garden, the writer's life. From Iron John, the boy who really did want his ball back threw caution to the winds, went into the castle and got the key. The cage door was not easy to open, and the boy pinched his finger. When the door stood open, the wild man walked through it, gave the boy the golden ball, and hurried away. The boy suddenly felt great fear. He shouted and cried out after him, "Wild man, if you go away, they will beat me." The wild man wheeled around, lifted the boy onto his shoulders, and walked with brisk steps into the forest. Regarding touchiness and wounding, Marie-Louise von Franz said, quote, "The inferior function and the sore spot are absolutely connected. The synergy created as a result of the innocent and wild parts of the psyche joining forces is pivotal. In type terminology, both the promise and the unknowns of the fourth function have declared themselves, even in all the confusion. And while the boy might not be consciously aware of the psychological shift, the wound inflicted by the escape is far less dangerous to the boy at this juncture than his remaining with his parents. Iron John, the wild psyche, has both communicated with and kept his promise to the boy. The lad has suddenly questioned the shelter of the known, and the choice to discover the unknown is made. Iron John tells the boy that though he will never see his mother and father again, he, Iron John, will watch over him, and he has more treasure than anyone else in the world. While one does not disregard the other functions when the inferior position awakens, the center of gravity nonetheless shifts. Von Franz put it this way, "The inferior function is the ever-bleeding wound of the conscious personality, but through it, the unconscious can always come in and so enlarge consciousness and bring forth a new attitude. The boy's world is thoroughly remade. He is growing in agency. Not only has he gone against civilized influences and stolen the key, but he has also struck out for wild territory, leaving both parents behind. The psyche requires boldness at times, and Bly summed it up best when he said, 'If a son can't steal the key, he doesn't deserve it.'" I've always loved that quote of his. "But stealing from the family of origin is often a fraught occasion. Reflecting on the original wound of my own upbringing, I know for certain that revisioning an empowered view of anger as an agent for relatedness and change was essential. With F.E. in my auxiliary position, I rarely present as an angry person, but I feel anger's raw energy and accept that I have not given voice enough to its appropriate expression." And so here I'm about to tell a story about a moment I had with my dad where he didn't think I should be angry again. No harm, no foul to dad. He was fine with me sharing this, but it's just such a great example of probably something he doesn't even remember, you know, other than the fact that I wrote about it, but like it lodged in me like, oh, you're not allowed to do this. So anyway, here we go. An example of how rare it was for me to express anger as a child occurred when I was 12, and my younger brother and I were playing with neighborhood kids a few blocks away from our home. My brother's bike started behaving erratically, and I hopped off my own bike to help out. In seeking to guide the chain back onto the spokes, I caught my finger between the spike and the metal cog. The injury immediately shot into a gushing wound. I yelled to no one in particular, "Damn!" My brother's eyes grew round in surprise, and he tore off in the direction of our house to tell Dad that I had used a cuss word, the little traitor. I couldn't believe it. If getting my finger caught between a metal chain and a spoke wasn't good enough occasion to curse, I didn't know what was. But I felt afraid, and sure enough, my dad was mad, inconceivably to me. He said he would have understood if I had slipped up and said damn with a group of friends. But he said to say such a word in anger, he emphasized, trailing off, not finishing his sentence. I was speechless. His argument made no sense to me, but I was powerless at that age to challenge the belief that what I had done was wrong. This early model of animus lodged itself deep within my psyche, coloring my actions and reactions for years. Predominantly, I could tell that my dad was uncomfortable with the energy that cursing signaled. How could little Lori have another side? We like her better the other way. But I also internalized that it was not okay to crack the facade of the respectable family. And I go on to give an example of, you know, I was kind of the darling one and always happy. And I had this fight with my dad once because I just wanted to be able, this was more like in high school years, and I just wanted to be able to get mad and not like have it be a major thing. You know, like I saw other teenagers could get mad and yell at their parents and like the whole family didn't tremble. And, you know, it kind of bounced off. And clearly those families had other things they were working through. So again, it's not an indictment. It was just this discomfort that was playing itself out in my family for whatever reason. And, you know, I'm sure my parents have their own perspective at the time, may not even remember what was going on for them. And like I said, I've done this with my kids for sure. Although I should say that I've kind of let them just have at it with the anger if they need to vent. So, you know, I've offered that to my children, maybe perhaps because I didn't feel that freedom. But again, at the core, it has nothing to do with the external family. I think it's because I've allowed myself to explore that anger can be enormously freeing and productive. It's depending on how much consciousness we're bringing to that feeling or that distinction between feeling and emoting. So it takes a while to get skillful with anger. And if one is never allowed to express it, the dark trickster nature is one option for its release. I look now with overdue compassion at my choice in a first husband. Perhaps it wasn't a choice at all, because I had to marry a man about to explode, a man who would unleash wreckage and public humiliation so I could start to understand the hidden value in chaos. In a sense, my original wound drove me into deeper situations that would ultimately demand I confront my first husband's betrayal, which was my second profound wound. I was strong enough to face it by then, and without a doubt, this dark face of the trickster continues to evolve. Realizing I have a choice in how I wield my anger is liberating. My animus is a good guide. He is teaching me the wisdom of giving creative expression to anger first, and when the occasion calls for it, speaking directly and without apology. And I would add to that now, you know, saying what needs to be said via the vehicle of the imagination. Like, I didn't even have that perspective when I wrote this article. So it just shows you how we continue to evolve with conscious communication and with becoming more skillful with feeling and emotion and these shadow aspects of personality. Back to my article, archetypal psychologist Kieran LeGrice, who was a professor of mine, illuminated the conscious animus when he stated, "A developed animus is only possible after one has made conscious and critically examined the ideas, beliefs, and opinions by which one lives and which one espouses and unconsciously entertains. When the animus is consciously differentiated from the ego, it can function as a principle of creativity and critical authority, fostering an independence of spirit and strength of ideas." Ironically, my relationship with my dad is better for the old king energy, referenced in Iron John, being dead. My difficult trickster has emerged as wickedly funny numerous times. My dad and I laugh. I use swear words, worse than damn, and we laugh some more. My dad rarely curses. He still finds it a little bit uncomfortable. That was at the time of the article. I don't know about right now. But he almost seems proud of the fact that I can and I do. Like the young man in the tale, I learned to trust my own wildness. By uniting the preferences of my dominant NI with the growing capacity of my SE, my approach to my writing career began to honor my own pace and style. For instance, I like to work earlier in the day with good strong coffee and then let my intuition take over the writing as I tend to my family and my home. In particular, my NI works keenly during sleep. My husband is precisely the opposite. Both his vocation and his art require him to work with his hands, an SE trait I greatly admire, and he much prefers to follow his inspiration into the night. The point is, in maturity, after much weeding and tending to wild shoots, one eventually finds one's way and enjoys the nature of it, allowing others to do the same. And I would add to that now, I've even shifted a bit from writing more to this interactive podcast experience. Would not have predicted that. And it's rewarding to me in the way writing was at one point. And then, you know, the creative threads of what I'm doing more on my website in terms of design is the form that's taking now. So we just never are still in terms of the soul's expression. And that's a beautiful thing, you know, like I almost don't even recognize the person I'm writing about in some aspects here because I've continued to evolve and pivot in other ways. But in terms of the personality, I could see how I, at this moment of writing the article, was plunging in more to those unconscious shadow functions, and they're becoming more accessible to me now, which is why I have so many different things happening in the external space. Back to the article, establishing sovereignty, finding the warrior within. Here's a quote from the Iron John folktale. You will receive that and more than you have asked for. The wild man turned, then went back into the woods, and not long afterwards, a stable boy came out of the trees leading a war horse that blew air through its nostrils and was not easy to hold on to. Running along after the horse came a large band of warriors, entirely clothed in iron, with their swords shining in the sun. The boy and his iron band rode there at full speed, galloped on the enemy like a hurricane, and struck down every one that opposed them. The young man has reached the moment when his warrior nature awakens. War has come to the land, but when he requests a horse in order to join the impending battle, he is laughed off by the other men and given a lame nag. Yet he will not be deterred. The young man is now self-possessed enough to ask something of life, to call out to Iron John for help. Psychologically, not only is the young man in the folktale in a time with no father, but he is also coming into relationship with a new king. Bly referred to this as a shift from the earthly father to finding one's inner sovereignty. He said, "The process of bringing the inner king back to life, when looked at inwardly, begins with attention to tiny desires, catching hints of what one really likes. Tiny desires ultimately lead to the discovery of a phoenix rising." My experience shows that the inner warrior sneaks up in unexpected moments. In illustration, my teenage son recently needed to finish an algebra test before school. I had an early engagement as well, which I had warned him about due to the fact that I was providing his ride. He slept in, poked around, yawned. One of us was going to be late. I felt a palpable mounting tension in my own being. Should I save him because his grade was no doubt going to be affected this late in the semester, or should I honor the sanity of my own schedule? I chose the latter. My son was incredulous. "Mom, you can't make me walk from here. I'm going to be late for Miss King. This is important." "Yes, I know. Good luck creating a miracle for yourself," I replied, grinning. My comment was absent of snark. I genuinely meant it. Feeling triumphant, I noticed the spring air swirling in through the open car windows, exploding with lilac scent, which my SE relished. I had just experienced my sword-wielding animus. He had stepped forward in good humor and made a choice that released both my son and me to our deeper resources. The school sent a letter home the following week indicating that my son would likely need to attend summer school for algebra. Like a boy possessed, my son sprang into action. He contacted his 8th grade math teacher and started meeting with her at Perkins for Pi and study sessions. In 3 weeks' time, he had raised his algebra grade by 10 percentage points. He passed with a solid C. I had to respect his moxie. My son's 20 now. I wonder if he remembers this. Shoemate described a person in command of a healthy, extroverted thinking function as one who, quote, may assume a can-do attitude that makes difficult tasks seem feasible. T.E. occupies my trickster position, but whereas I once relied on the subterfuge to achieve an end, I am changing this weaker pattern through conscious engagement with my animus. As I demonstrated to my son, T.E. in the trickster position can also, quote, replace old rules with new ones and persuade others to comply. The warhorse is a vibrant example of what an evolved trickster can produce, what an awakened, battle-savvy animus can accomplish. According to Shoemate, B.B. has proposed that the inferior function can only be integrated if we have first accessed the trickster function. When I became aware of my trickster capacity, my TE and SE joined forces with each other, and the outcome was not only an exhilarating departure from my comfort zone, but also a strategic strike from the psyche's wisdom. The emergence of play and creativity in my life, as well as the reclaiming of appropriate anger, has greatly assisted me in getting out of my own way. In the words of analyst and author Marion Woodman, quote, we must first awaken to our needs, feelings, and values. Then the masculine can grow up and say, I shall stand up for these needs, feelings, and values. I shall put them out there in the world. I shall work with you in all your creativity. The inner union is indeed the work of a lifetime. But to establish inner sovereignty, to both intimately know and rely upon such an electric healing force, is fine incentive to keep going. I have a father, a husband, a son. I wish to understand them better. And I have an inner king guiding the ways in which I will skillfully command my creative work in the world. At present, Sly, my 3-year-old cat, nudges against my hip. My children brought Sly and his brother Cola home as orphaned kittens. Being a dog person until the cat's arrival, I find them to be funny and unexpected. Cola is the silvery color of the severed cat in my long-ago dream, and Sly is, both in spirit and color, a miniature Black Panther, decidedly uncaged. Beebe referenced the developed superior and inferior functions as establishing a spine of consciousness. The psyche not only revealed my once severed condition, but also the means by which I could refuse, discerning, deciding, and reclaiming on my own terms. Beebe once explained his spine metaphor in an interview with author James Araj. This definition of the spine is a very real thing. That sense of self we all have is along that mysterious axis between what we are best at and what we are worst at, which is the spine of our personality. And there is our uprightness. There is our integrity. Another way of saying this metaphorically and analogically is that a personality needs to drop anchor. I marvel at the daily reminders I have in the wiry playfulness displayed by Cola and Sly. But the most moving realization is the knowing that while I seek the inner marriage, it is also seeking me. So, how I would summarize this, again, knowing how much value my recent engagement with imagination brings to this conversation. Just in terms of the inner marriage, I am so devoted to the juice of that unconscious material in the inner life and keeping the emphasis there because the external must mirror this. And so often I'm learning now when I really, really, really want to say something to my husband or say something to my kids or do something externally with my business, I am pausing and saying, what is driving that desire? And I'm seeing that 9 times out of 10, it's something internal that is wanting to be known, an old idea that is wanting to be set aside, a new perspective that's wanting a playful touch, a new way of using my imagination to invoke a solution. I'm finding that most things that I should be engaging with externally, be it conversations or activities or decisions that have an external aspect to them, I read this the other day, the best way to engage in any of that is to first make sure you're in an excellent mood. Because that means you're not running around triggered and you're trying to do external maintenance for something that's internal. And number two, I'm finding that most of the things that are required in an external thing are really just chore kind of level things. So for example, making dinner, which of course you can do with a lot of heart and joy and enthusiasm, but I'm just saying, you know, I have to make dinner still, or I need to go to the post office, or I need to, you know, put gas in my car. But these are sort of chore level things, which is allowing me to have the emphasis of the interior life, of the inner marriage, be work I'm doing with my soul in my meditation, in the work of this podcast, with Transurfing Reality principles, all of those sorts of things. And then I can just enjoy my people and enjoy my friends and enjoy my family and enjoy the things that bring me a sense of happiness in terms of hobbies and the work that I do. So it's not about infusing the external stuff anymore with this better fulfill me, because it can't. I know that now. I know that in every fiber of my being. However, a fulfilled woman does fulfilling things. A fulfilled woman has a fulfilling marriage. A fulfilled woman is vital and alive. So this exploration of Iron John and finding that gold in the psyche that is present underneath the denser aspects of the personality and of the habits that we've learned in our human story, that gold is there. And that gold, that discovery of that gold, will only release all of our dreams for ourselves into the external space. So I hope, again, this exploration of the shadow and how it's maybe moving through the personality. Again, whatever your personality is, you're going to have different aspects in different positions than my INFJ preference. But hopefully you can see in broad terms how bringing those aspects into greater awareness, it's an ongoing thing, is allowing that spine of personality. And I would argue, and I think I've said this before in the context of the podcast, it's allowing when all of those personality factors have more awareness to them, then the whole conscious and unconscious aspects of the spine are so much greater. It's getting into that divinity, authenticity, capital self space where, yes, your personality is still an aspect of who you are and your gifts in the world, but you're so much larger than that. And you're this creative force in the eternal now, to borrow a phrase from last time. So much to think about and contemplate. Just let this wash over you. I know I've brought in many moving pieces today, and we'll just sort of sit with it and be with it. And we'll conclude next time with sort of the mystical aspect of the inner life that may remain a mystery while we are still on this side of death. And that's okay. It can still affect us. It can still color our experience in extraordinary ways. So we'll conclude with that next time. But until next time, take good care. Hi, everyone. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to hit subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if my work is nourishing your heart and imagination, consider supporting the Apothecary Podcast. Just follow the links to make a contribution. And for the full scope of my projects and offerings, including my weekly newsletter, visit lorigreen.net.